This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. By way of announcements, Dayton ICU Consulting will be hosting a free webinar dedicated to the financial benefits of the ABCDEF bundle. It will be on October 18th at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can register using the link in the show notes of this episode. Please invite your colleagues and especially leadership. This is a taste of the presentation I can do on site with your hospital and ICU leadership to prove to them that investing thousands into adequate staffing, training, equipment, and education will save them millions of dollars in healthcare costs. Now, for this episode, I am so excited to start our 8-week series dedicated to the ABCDEF bundle. The next 8 weekly episodes will be focused on each letter and element of the ABCDEF bundle. For those of you that have been longtime listeners, this may seem like old news. The ABCDEF bundle has been around for about 7 years or so, but in these episodes, we're going to really clarify and fine-tune some things. To be honest, we're going to address some hard truths, as you know, I always do. I'm finding out when I mention the ABCDEF bundle to people outside of the ICU revolutionist circle, I usually have one of two different responses. One is sometimes, what is that? Even from ICU clinical leadership, some still do not know what the ABCDEF bundle is. Or the other and most common response is, quote, oh yeah, we do the ABCDEF bundle, we do our SATs and SBTs. Which is actually not that comforting to me. As I've been diving into the charting, data, meeting with clinicians around the country and world, being at the bedside with the teams, and then comparing my own experiences throughout many ICUs as a travel nurse, I am confident that the ICU community is generally misunderstanding the ABCDEF bundle and therefore falling short of compliance. Our teams, hospitals, and especially our patients are in constant crisis because we don't understand the purpose and the vision of the bundle. The ABCDEF bundle is not an on and off switch for sedation. If we're just focusing on SATs and SBTs for bundle compliance, then we're really not understanding what the bundle is really for and how to practice it. I have seen that we have taken these letters and often interpreted them as the following. A, for assess, prevent, and manage pain, has become automatically start fentanyl upon intubation, increase sedation for restlessness or agitation. B, for both spontaneous awakening and breathing trials, has become only try an SAT once ventilator settings are low. Turn sedation down just enough to see them thrash, then resume. Try a breathing trial if you can. If they fail, turn sedation back on and consider trying again tomorrow. C, choice of analgesia and sedation is understood as automatically start sedation and opioids immediately on everyone, but consider avoiding benzodiazepines if you can. D, delirium assessment, prevention, and treatment is currently just require CAM and RAS charting in the EMR. If they're sedated, just put unable to assess. If the ICU, most everyone is going to be confused, but not much we can do. Just chart it if you can. E, early mobility and exercise is now consider ordering physical or occupational therapy after extubation. For now, just turn them every 2 hours if they're intubated and chart the highest level of mobility as bed rest so that charting compliance is 100%. F, family engagement. Allow for some visitation during the day. They don't have to be in rounds, but if they're in the corner of the room, chart that. Now, of course, those are gross generalizations and not fully accurate for every team and especially not every clinician. There is a significant spectrum of compliance and culture with the ABCDEF bundle. You have teams that still automatically sedate their patients, usually deeply and often with benzodiazepines, but they may chart some SATs and SBTs when ventilator settings are low. Then you have the 100% compliance teams that are awake and walking ICUs in which they only give sedation when there is an indication for sedation. When there's an indication for sedation, they give the safest sedative at the lowest dose for the shortest duration possible. Patients are performing their highest level of mobility unless there's a contraindication to mobility, and families are deeply involved as part of the team without restrictions. Then you have teams that fall anywhere in between. Some may never use benzodiazepines, but patients are still at a RASS of negative 3 or deeper and mobility is rare. Or teams that only lightly sedate their patients but still haven't standardized mobility. This was well captured in the 2019 ABCDEF bundle study with over 15,000 patients in 68 facilities. You're going to hear me reference this study a lot. Of course, there was a lot of variation in the bundle as the bundle was new, and there were a lot of teams involved. They found that 100% compliance with the bundle was at only 8%. Only 12% of those patients were on their feet bearing weight. Nonetheless, the average impact from those improvements to sedation and mobility among those 68 facilities resulted in a 68% decrease in 7-day mortality. Coma and delirium decreased by 25 to 50%. Restraint use decreased by 60%. There was a drastic decrease in mechanical ventilation use. Patients were 46% less likely to be readmitted to the ICU, and they were 36% more likely to discharge home. They also found that these outcomes were dose dependent. The closer teams got to an awake and walking ICU approach or 100% compliance with the bundle, the better their outcomes were. Ultimately, we will never achieve true mastery and compliance with the ABCDEF bundle if we do not truly understand the objective of the bundle and how to utilize and customize each tool within the bundle. In this episode, we have one of the ABCDEF bundle founders, Michelle Ballas, here to give us the history and true vision of the ABCDEF bundle. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I am excited. I've seen your name all over the research for years. I don't know how we haven't met before, but this is really exciting. Can you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Absolutely. I'm equally thrilled to meet you. My name is Michelle Ballas. I am currently the Associate Dean of Research at the University of Nebraska Medical Center College of Nursing. Relatively new to that role. Great opportunity working with some really fantastic young nurse scientists and established investigators who are aiming to change the world. So I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, you have done so much incredible work in the ABCDEF bundle realm, ICU liberation projects. How did that even start?
Well, that's a great question. We spoke a little bit before the podcast, but I'm going to have to say that a lot of my work was influenced by my everyday clinical practice. I was a nurse in a surgical trauma intensive care unit, and I was working in a unit that I'm going to say was kind of like Nirvana or heaven, if you think about it. So this was probably, this was in the 90s. At the time, we had an amazing clinical nurse specialist by the name of Joanne Phillips. And our normal practice was really heavily influenced by her. So in those days, we already had the culture of getting people up and walking. And if you didn't get your patient out of bed that day, she was kind of in your face in what I perceived to be a good way, asking why, but more importantly, asking how could she help, right? So she was one of those leaders that just didn't expect the nurses to get the patients out of bed. She would be there physically to help us, you know, walk the walk. So she was amazing. I say it was like a Nirvana because the nurses that I worked with were all just super fantastic and skilled in their own way. We had a great group of complementary skills. And it was a fantastic practice environment. Our respiratory therapists, physicians, we would go out to eat, you know, breakfast after night shift and things like that. It was a great interprofessional team. So I was very lucky that my early days of practice took place in an ICU that was very patient focused.
Yeah, I don't know what comes first, the great environment that leads to the early mobility or the early mobility that leads to the environment. Yeah, you have to work together. You bond with each other.
Yeah. Well, back then, there wasn't really any evidence supporting what we were doing. I mean, early mobility wasn't a thing. It was just kind of one of those like duh moments. Like, is it better to keep a patient in bed and not mobilize them, get the pressure sores and all of the, you know, complications that come with bed rest? I mean, we knew bed rest is bad for decades. Predators were, right? Bed rest is bad for every single part of your body. And, you know, I think a little bit of it has been tempered by too, that we were it was a surgical ICU. So back then, surgeons kind of expected that their patients were up and walking as soon as possible.
Right. But in the 90s, that's when most of the ICU community started to really adapt this deep sedation and immobility for everyone on a ventilator for any reason.
Yeah, because the ARDS trials, right? Low tidal volume. Tidal volume did a lot, right? Because those patients, you know, that those studies that we were part of those clinical trials required patients to have neuromuscular blockade, which then necessitates sedation and adequate pain management. Yep.
And we still haven't really compared patients being awake with low tidal volumes settings versus being paralyzed and sedated on low tidal volume settings. So that's a whole nother ARDS discussion down the road, but that is where, you know, the ARDS research is what really hit us off to this wildfire effect of a quick sedate everyone on a ventilator for any reason, no questions asked. Now, here we are in 2023, and that's still been a problem that we're facing. But then how did we start to evolve from there as far as the different guidelines and the research that you've been involved with?
Well, the evolution has actually been pretty interesting to watch. I mean, I think probably in several other podcasts, you've covered how it started with CRESS and the shutting off sedation and then demonstrating that that was effective, that patients were able to be on the ventilator without sedation. Even back in the 90s, we weren't doing it to be mean. We weren't sedating people to be mean. In fact, I was on Twitter yesterday and my head almost exploded. It almost explodes every day on Twitter for a number of reasons. But I saw somebody comment on one of Wes Ely's questions about deep sedation, saying that, you know, that this is going to come back and haunt you guys, the people that are saying, you know, to minimize sedation because all these patients were going to get PTSD and things like that. We were doing the right thing. I remember being a nurse saying that if I'm ever in here and I'm ever in a car accident and I'm this sick, and if you don't sedate me and I die, I'm going to come back and haunt you. Like, it was ingrained in our soul that the proper thing to do was to sedate people.
It's part of
that historical context and that belief that still is present today with many well-meaning ICU clinicians. That's really, really hard to break.
Absolutely. And we started getting more research, more data showing the harm of those things. So how did the ABCDF bundle come to be? How did your team create this protocol to address those problems and change this approach?
My life has been guided by serendipity. I mean, I had the blessing of working with Wes Ely, even in my PhD program. You know, this random nurse who's going to school emails the biggest guru in ICU research and, you know, could you help me? And he said, yes. So one of the big takeaway points that I've learned in my life is that if somebody comes and is really passionate about a topic, say yes to help them. You know, the reason that I do this work and that I've committed my work to this was all based on a patient story. And it was not so much early mobility related, but it was something that literally changed my life. And I think about almost daily. We were caring for a relatively young woman who was brought to our ICU really, really sick after a motor vehicle crash. I mean, she was really sick. She had liver lacerations, broken ribs, went into severe ARDS, like really sick on admission. And at the time, she was also like 20 weeks pregnant. And so back then, you know, the thing that we had to do is really focus on helping the mom survive her injuries. And that was the best chance for the baby to be able to survive. So we were able to get her through kind of the acute phase of illness. And then one day, kind of almost out of the blue, she had a really active husband who'd come and visit her family. They hated leaving her. Back then, we had restricted ICU visitation. Like, how antiquated is that notion? You know, we made the family members leave the bedside, leave their loved ones when they're dying.
It's just
But out of the blue, one night she got really super confused. So she started like pulling at her lines and tubes, was like trying to kick. And she was really on high vent settings at that point. And we were afraid that, you know, if she pulled out her lines and tubes, she wouldn't be able to live. So we did what we thought was, again, best practice back then. We heavily sedated her, right? We gave her every PRN that was on her list. So she got her benzos, she got all of her opioids, she got her probably Benadryl. God forbid if people are still using Benadryl for sleep. but she also got really high doses of Haldol, like really high doses. Now, again, this is in the 90s. So this is when we were pushing 5 milligrams, 5 milligrams, 5 milligrams until the patient went down. Again, back then, that was kind of normal practice.
We didn't know.
The next day I came in to take care of her and I walked in to do my report. And, you know, the nurse told me how terrible her night was. And I touched her hand and I never felt something so hot in my life. Took her temperature, 106.7. ICU nurse, that can't be right. Took it again, 106.8. Oh my God. So, you know, I called for help, pulled back the covers, and didn't she deliver her baby in the bed? The baby was there right between her legs. We called the OB. It was too late. Baby died. So we had to, again, kind of focus on taking care of the mom. It's something that I'll never forget. We don't know what happened. We don't know if maybe her agitation the night before was her trying to tell us she was going into labor. She couldn't tell us, right? She was ventilated. Her wrists were restrained. We used to think wrist restraints were good and that would protect people from harm. We know that's not true, too. You know, we didn't give her a way to communicate. Could she have told us, you know, maybe she was going into labor and that's why she was getting so wiggy? We just assumed she was agitated, you know, like patients become in the ICU sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, you know, maybe that's what she was trying to tell us. We don't know. My intuition to this day, nobody will ever change my mind. I deem the situation probably likely to come about from all of the Haldol that we gave her. Right? Neuromalignant syndrome from the Haldol. Everybody says it's rare, never happens. Well, I've seen it 4 or 5 times.
Wow.
But yeah, never happens. So that's why I actually went back to my to get my PhD. I never wanted another person who was confused to be treated the way we treated her. Again, with our best intentions in mind. We did everything that we thought was right back then. Calm her down, keep her comfortable, protect her airway, restrain her. And I've just committed that would never happen to again, particularly with older adults who are my passion and my love of life. I love this sweet, confused older adult that many people find honestly challenging to care for. So that's kind of why I did that. And it's still what guides my research is and how I got involved with the ABCDE bundle. So the bundle was thrown out there theoretically, just based on all of the great randomized control trials that we had that supported all these interventions. Why not put them all together, right? What would happen if we put them all together? We didn't know what would happen if we put them all together, the ABCDE. So I worked with... my team was the first to test what would happen if you put the bundle into everyday care. We did that at the Nebraska Medical Center and we found really great results. Since that time, my takeaway is every study that's ever been done on the bundle has found extremely consistent results. Extremely consistent. I challenge people when I speak to show me a study where the ABCDE bundle doesn't benefit patients. It's consistent. Mortality, length of stay, you know, ICU length of stay, what does that matter? That just depends on beds in the med-surg area. But improving delirium, improving coma, getting people off the ventilator earlier, getting people home as opposed to a new institutionalization. Every single outcome improves consistently. We've also demonstrated the more you get, the better, right?
Right. That 2019 study looking at the bundle across over 15,000 patients in 68 facilities. I just have to share those results. They found that 7-day mortality decreased by 68%. Readmissions decreased by 46%. Coma and delirium decreased by 25 to 50%. Patients were 36% more likely to go home. Restraint use decreased by 60%. Mechanical ventilation decreased. I mean, those are incredible outcomes. But if you look at compliance, the 100% compliance only hit at 8%. Only 8% of those patients had 100% compliance. Only 12% of those 15,000 plus patients were on their feet bearing weight. But they found that it was dose dependent. The closer the care got to an awakened walk-in ICU approach, the better their outcomes were. So those statistics, though they're impressive and exciting, that's an average with all of those outcomes combined.
So we did publish a paper on that. I mean, these sites that were in the ICU Liberation Collaborative, top notch. Again, the most motivated ICUs in the country. They're taking all this time, treasure, and talent and investing it into the ABCDE bundle. We want to do the right thing. On a positive day, my positive friends are always like, we tripled it, right? We tripled ABCDF bundle performance. That's fantastic. And it's great, right? Because we know what it does to patient outcomes.
Anything you do is
when we look at it overall, I think in those 68 ICUs, we only got to 12%. Compliant, you know, adherence to the ABCDE bundle. So there are great opportunities for improvement. You know, what's interesting is, again, hundreds probably now, Dina Costa Kelly did a great review not too long ago about all the challenges. We know it's hard to do this, right? These people that say, just do it. It's the right thing. We have to do it for their patients. They're not speaking reality, Kelly. It's hard.
Especially when you're deeply rooted. And these cultural practices, I think once people have it mastered, they have that skill set, they are comfortable with it. It's not that hard. It's about, you know, the difficulty doesn't far surpass what we're doing as a norm. It's getting there that is so hard. That transition is where the challenge lies.
Yep. So we're actually looking now. So again, we know hundreds of studies supporting the individual bundle elements and how great they all are. All of these studies showing the ABCDE bundle works. Now studies showing it works, but nobody's using it. So our research that we're doing now, we're so blessed, just got a grant from the National Heart and Lung, NHLBI, and the National Institute of Nursing Research. How cool is this? I could die now. This is my dream study. So we know these things work. We know nobody does them. Well, not nobody, but there's some great performing ICUs like we know we practice in. How can we help clinicians do it? What strategies work? We know the barriers, right? We know the barriers. You need physical bodies to mobilize patients. Nobody will tell me different. And mainly that always involves a nurse, Callie, right? We know that. The nurses are intimately involved
in
almost every single bundle element. So in this study, how cool is this? We are going to test two different implementation strategies. We're going to have units that are randomized to either get this dashboard that's displayed in the ICU. So everybody, patients, families, other ICU clinicians, whatever, will know this dashboard will be there and it'll have the A, B, C, D, E, F, and they'll know whether or not those elements were received in the last 24 hours. So did the patient get up and walking? Right. We'll have it set up in a way. So for the early mobility, red will be green. They'll do their safety screens. If they pass their safety screens, they'll get them up and moving in bed, out of bed. Right. So it'll be green, yellow, red, whether or not they received it that day. That's one arm. So half of the units are going to get this visual reminder. Please, 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 please do these things. This is where we are as a unit. Oh, what's going on here? Maybe the nurses could help here, or the respiratory therapist could, you know, do this.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
The other arm, ready?
I'm ready.
Is going to get an extra nurse. And this nurse is going to act kind of like your CNS and my CNS did in the past almost as an RN ABCDEF bundle facilitator. She's not going to have an assignment, right? She's going to be there to help the whole ICU as needed to get these patients the ABCDF bundle.
That, you know, I have a team that I worked with that I trained. They kind of beat you to it because they, as they were working through this, they found the gaps. They also started seeing the financial benefits. They were able to justify getting an ICU liberation nurse.
Oh, that would be, is this published?
No, I want them to publish it. I hope they publish it. It's fairly new for them. It's within the last couple of months. But no, that is the only purpose, is to go around saying, where are they at with the bundle? What do you need? Why aren't they up? Let's get up. Let's get the sedation off. Like, I mean, they're there just for that. And they rotate through. So everyone gets the experience of looking up the whole unit.
Oh, fantastic idea.
I know. Yeah. And they come up with that on their own. That wasn't my idea, but they were able to justify that because of the progress that they've already made.
Yeah.
To say, to go all the way, this is what we need. And this is financially very justifiable, huge return on investment. But I think that's perfect, because that was one of my roles as a nurse practitioner, is to oversee that, to look at the big picture. Yep. And that was in a team that already had the process very established, that everyone had that skill. We still needed that oversight. So especially mm-hmm. for teams that are really, you know, in the trenches of working on this, that is very, very valid. What a great resource. I'm excited to see the evidence from that.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have equipoise in research, right? We don't know which one's going to work better.
Right.
Kind of. Don't want to cheat, but I kind of have my assumption on my hypothesis of which one will work better. I think both will be better than usual care. And so this study is going to help us see, you know, all the great work that's been done by the past by leaders in the field, you know, outlining these barriers of facilitators. We're taking those barriers and facilitators, moving beyond that. We don't need to know what inhibits us anymore. We know the problems. Now let's test strategies to see if we can overcome that. So congratulations to the team that's done that. I'm more than willing to help them if they want to get that work out there. But I think we'll have finally some evidence and see, you know, the effect that it has on patient outcomes and the effect that it has on bundle adoption. Hopefully it'll help get the safe, effective practice into everyday ICU care.
That is so exciting. And I think if we zoom out more, let's talk about what the objective of all of this is. What is the objective of the ABCDF bundle? Because I worked with one of those first rollout teams in 2016 as a travel nurse. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't part of the formal training, but what I got at the bedside was, okay, at 5 a.m, we have to do this really annoying thing where you turn on sedation, you crash, you turn it back on. That's what I caught of the bundle, right? Mm-hmm. So I think as I'm working with teams, I'm seeing this gap where we're not understanding the objective of it. We're seen as a task list. These are mandated things in the charting system, which you can work around in 10 different ways, right?
Yeah.
So what is the actual objective of the ABCDF bundle?
In my opinion, the objective is to obviously help people survive, but it's so much more than that. It's having patients while they're in the ICU, being awake, engaged, able to interact with their family, able to communicate with the ICU providers. In my example, hey, you know, I'm having contractions. Hey, I'm having pain. Hey, I forgot my dog. My dog's home alone and nobody's caring for it. And that's why I'm quote unquote agitated. Them awake and be able to interact, whether or not, I mean, some people are going to die. Wouldn't it be better to be at least able to communicate to your family, to your loved ones, what your needs were, what you're sorry about, what you wish you could have done, how much you love somebody. If I'm laying in bed, you know, I don't want to just pass slowly. I want to be able to tell my kids, I love you. I'm proud of you. So giving them that opportunity. But more importantly, we don't want all these people just to survive the ICU to have the worst life ever later, right? We want them to go back to work. We want them to have healthy family relationships, to be engaged in their community, to be able to partake in the things that they like. And if we're not harming them in the ICU with practices that we know harm people, that's a great step forward to empowering them to be healthier later. We want healthy people later. And it's hard when we're doing the, you know, minute by minute routines to get past, you know, the patient that's coding in room 2. I mean, we still Our priority is the patient that's coding in room right. two. But to bring it back to, but you know, it's just as important that the patient that's getting a little bit better, that we help them maintain their muscle mass, maintain their brain, so that they could have a high functioning life later on. It's hard to think in the long term, particularly if the ICU providers are never provided with what happens to their patients in the long term.
Right. And when Wes talks about how the acronym came to be, just that it was something catchy to adapt it to, right? You have all these different elements, cues, and you're trying to figure out something to help people quickly Stick. Remember and organize it, right? But those of us downwind have taken it as a very sequential thing, right? So you're going to automatically sedate patients. Yeah, you have to give them opioids. Then you're going to do breathing trials down the road. And that was never the objective, is to still sedate mm-hmm. people. I feel like we're holding on so tight to sedation and immobility and still trying to walk and move forward. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Ely,
that's based in science. Your statement's based in science. When we look at that ICU Liberation Collaborative, guess what the three hardest things were to do? Guess what the hardest was to do?
Mobilize.
The least performed.
Right. Because we didn't get to the rest, because we create so much difficulty when we start sedation, we cause delirium, then it's hard to peel off sedation. And so how can we get to the mobility side? And we make this really complicated. I mean, I appreciate the dashboards and everything, but I liked what Dr. Ely said in a webinar just recently. He said, when we're looking at the bundle, we just need to ask three questions when we're looking at compliance. Are they awake? Are they out of the bed? Where's the family? Mm-hmm. Are they awake? Are they out of the bed? Where's the family? And so I have a picture of a car down a highway with a road sign, and the car is the bundle. The road is ICU Liberation. The destination on that road sign says awake and walking ICUs.
Love that.
That's what we're working towards. That is the vision. And when we finally have a clear vision, then we can optimize the tools that we've been given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like Heidi Engel's approach too, right? We'd be at these meetings together and she's like, we're not supposed to start with the A. I mean, we had to start somewhere. So that sticky message is important. That's why sometimes I get a little nervous if we call it different names at this point, right? But here, there, here, not. But if she always challenged us to think, what if you think E first?
Or
it kind of does make sense, right? If you think E first, you can't do E without shutting off the sedation, or at least having the patient awake. So at least it triggers that awake.
Right.
So that's a great strategy.
If we have to go sequentially, let's do F to A. So family, if our goal is to have them engaged, really connecting, communicative, engaged with family, then we're not going to sedate them. And then they're going to be ready for mobility. And then we're going to be managing sedation with the C appropriately. And then we really are going to be preventing and treating delirium. Okay. So I think if we have to go in a very specific order, if we're still needing to do a conveyor belt approach, let's start from the bottom up.
Agree, but not all patients are going to have family. Some family will have challenges getting in. I think that'll vary. I think there's disparities in health. I mean, if you're talking to somebody that's in the ICU from a rural community, they might not be there every day. I also worry about burdening families. I was always about, let the families, if they want to help with mobility, why not? And one of my other really wise mentors puts up we got to consider where the families are as well. I mean, this is normal to us. Seeing people on the ventilator and stuff is normal to us. How much stress and burden do we want to put on the families to be involved with care that we should be providing, that is in our scope of practice, which is another interesting thing that probably a whole other podcast. We could talk about those structural and organizational things that stop us from doing it. And until we get to the root cause and put our big boy pants on and talk about some of the challenges nurses are facing on a daily basis that are structural, it's going to be hard. So I'm going to still, I think in my head, kind of go with the Engel philosophy with think of the E. Mm-hmm. But that F is tough. It's tough to define. It's tough to measure. And it's probably, again, the most important part. They're not our patients. They're their families.
Right. And they are the experts on them. But again, every family has different levels of capacity, comfort, takes intuition to know how to involve the families at the right level for them. We also have institutional barriers. So we have now very restrictive visitation hours. I'm seeing 9 to 7 in some facilities. I mean, would you kick out a respiratory therapist at 7 o'clock at night? It's insane. So then bedside clinicians, what can they do? How do they, they're now, you've cut off.
Where did they even get the idea that it's okay for us to restrict families from seeing their loved ones? Like where did we organizationally think that that was okay, that there are patients, not their families?
COVID. But didn't we learn during COVID that that was inhumane? Didn't we learn?
Yes.
That? And then we still didn't fully go back to where we had been from the previous A-F bundle rollouts. We had really moved towards open ICUs. We went back 100 miles and now we're only back. We've only come 50 miles since then.
But so, it may be a blessing, like you're putting up, right? Because it showed us the barbarity of restricting family visitation. Family member is dying. Let's stop you from seeing them. I'm not talking about COVID. I understand the complexities there. That's not easy. And I'm not blaming hospitals for restricting family visitors in a time that we didn't know what was going to happen, right? We didn't know.
Right.
They get a pass there. The pass, we don't get a pass that we were doing it before and we're still doing it now.
We know very well now the evidence supports it, which, you know, we're doing episodes on each element of the bundle. So F will really hit hard the evidence that supports full family visitation involvement. But, you know, from a family perspective, what if families knew about the bundle, that if they knew that their loved one would have a 68% chance, greater chance of being alive in 7 days if the bundle was being applied? Is this a liability for teams if we don't comply with the bundle? Should this be considered standard of care?
Oh, by far, yes. It should not. I'm not saying not yes to the liability, because again, there's structural things that stop us from doing it. So I don't think liability. I love your idea of telling the family or giving the family pamphlets about why we're doing stuff. What a great idea, right? Fantastic idea.
And I have a podcast for families. It's called Walking You Through the ICU, so that the clinicians don't have to sit there and try to explain delirium, ICU cord weakness. It's a lot. It takes a lot of time. So my goal is to just give them that podcast where it's succinct and catered for them where they're at.
That's fantastic. We also have an early stage investigator here who's working on an app to help with family engagement that'll hopefully be coming down the pipe very soon. But yeah, absolutely, 100% yes, should be considered standard of care. Yes, there should be. We have a responsibility to do the bundle as the best we can. In terms of liability, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I can't speak to that, but I know that there's challenges that make it very, very hard to do the best care.
And I only bring that up because there's so much hesitation to comply with the bundle because they're afraid of liability. But if we understood how this could look on paper,
right,
that the bundle's been proven to be life-saving, and if we fail to comply with it, could there be down the road, as the public understands more, could we be held accountable for failing to provide the standard of care?
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating, right? Particularly with the E. So everybody's worrying that their patients are going to fall and get this terrible thing. Patients are going to fall. It's going to happen. They're going to fall whether you're walking them or not walking them. They're going to pull out tubes, whether they're restrained, non-restrained. It's interesting because if you think, and we're going to have to deal with this with our grant, like, okay, what are the potential adverse events, right, of early mobility? The adverse events are really more likely to occur in the patients that aren't getting the early mobility. So I think that's kind of what you're talking about, meaning there is more harm that's going to occur if they're not mobilized. So if anything, the liability risk should be on keeping them in bed. That's the liability. That's where you're going to run, I don't know if it's liability risk or iatrogenic. It's definitely the iatrogenic risk, right? We know there's more harm keeping people in bed, but how do you describe that? Everybody thinks is the fall is the bad thing, as opposed to the pressure ulcer, as opposed to the deconditioning, as opposed to the cognitive impairment that's coming from deep sedation and immobility and things like that. So changing that from a liability perspective is interesting.
No, absolutely. And we just need to understand that this is how you save lives.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
And period. That if we're not doing it, we're not giving patients the best chance to survive and thrive. So Michelle, thank you so much for your decades of dedication to this and the hard work. And your name is all over the research. And you have saved lives that you will never touch, which is amazing.
And let me just say the same thing to you. As I said before, doing things like the podcast, you're doing such a service to the ICU community, but more importantly, particularly if you're doing this for the families, oh my God, think of the millions of families and people that you will never touch or see that you're changing with this. So I'm so happy that you were brought into my life, and please, please commit to keep doing this important work.
Absolutely. No, there's a whole movement happening. There's a huge group of ICU revolutionists that are joining the ranks. No,
I love that. I love
big things are happening. So yep. Awakened Walking ICUs are the future of critical care medicine. We will master the APCDF bundle. You will see it in your lifetime. So thank you so much.
I will. I'm convinced.
A consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.